The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin.
Buenas tardes a todos y muchas gracias por atender. That's about as much as I know. I'm sorry. Not going to be able to keep up. But thank you so much for coming here, and thank you very much for Rafael Del Pino Foundation for inviting me here. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to be in this beautiful setting. And thank you so much to Planeta and Deusto for publishing my book in Spanish and allowing me to reach a whole new audience and giving me more of an incentive to keep learning Spanish. This is my first time in Madrid, second time in Madrid, the first time in 36 years. The first time I came here, I was 2 years old, 1982. My father brought me here because my father lived in Madrid for 7 years, so he's very happy that I'm speaking here. He studied medicine at the University of Madrid and he became a doctor here, so he's watching back home and he's very proud of me, and thank you very much for giving me this chance to make my father proud. Today, the topic of my talk is about El Patron Bitcoin, or the Bitcoin Standard, and that's the name of my book. In a brief, what I'm going to talk about is, you know, I don't have time, unfortunately, to cover obviously all of topics of my book, but I'm going to talk about some of the main ideas, and I'm going to talk about them briefly to give you an idea about what the book talks about, so that if you are interested, you can hopefully pick up the book and read more about it, and hopefully we can also discuss them afterwards. After I finish my talk, we'll have more of a chance to get in depth into these discussions. The first interesting thing about Bitcoin is that it is completely unique as a form of money in a way that is different from anything that we've seen before. So why that is the case, in my opinion, the way that I see it is this. Anything can be used as money. There's no clear physical or legal reason that says what has to be money or what can't be money. Money is a medium of exchange, and so anytime you decide to buy something, not for its own sake, but in order to exchange it with something else later on, you're effectively using it as a medium of exchange. So there's nothing to stop anything from being used as money, but there is a problem with most things being used as money, which is that if something gets used as money, its value rises because everybody's buying more of it, but that gives more of an incentive for the people who can produce it, who can make more of it, to produce more of it, which in turn brings the value down. And so you end up in this trap where anything that gets chosen as money has the value rise and then the value drops afterwards. And so it ends up not being useful as a store of value. So because of that, the only things that end up getting used as money we find throughout history are things that are hard to produce, that are hard for people to make more of. So we see cattle, seashells, glass beads, metals, precious metals, and then even within government money, we see that the successful examples of money are usually kinds of money that are very hard to produce. And the harder they are to produce, the longer they are likely to serve as money, and the easier they are to produce, the less likely they are to continue to serve as money. So if that was true, if my theory about this is true, then Bitcoin is extremely interesting because it is the hardest money that we have ever invented. It's the hardest thing to produce. And this chart here shows us the supply curve for Bitcoin. As you can see, the quantity of Bitcoin is going to end up being stable at around 21 million. And there's no possibility for anybody to make more Bitcoin beyond that. And we can discuss why maybe during the Q&A. But generally, the growth rate of Bitcoin continues to decline with time. The coins are added on, and they're added on at a declining rate. Every 4 years, the new supply drops by half. And so eventually, it levels off at 21 million coins in total. So this makes Bitcoin unique, because with every other asset, if it gets chosen as a form of money, if people choose it as money, then the price of it rises and people will produce more of it. And that's true for everything from copper to seashells to gold to silver. People will dig more and they will produce more. It's also true for government money. Government will always have the temptation to make more money, to print more money, to lower interest rates, to offer lower loans. And any form of money always faces this, if you want, inefficiency or imperfection, which is that more of it can be made if demand for it rises, except Bitcoin. It's completely unique in this regard because if somebody chooses it as a store of value, its price goes up, but there's no possibility for increasing the supply. Instead, and those of you who are familiar with how Bitcoin works technically will recognize the term difficulty adjustment. What happens with Bitcoin is that if the value of Bitcoin rises, more people try to buy Bitcoin, more people try to produce Bitcoin. They do not produce more Bitcoin. What they end up doing is, what ends up happening is that the difficulty of mining Bitcoin becomes higher. In other words, it becomes more expensive to produce Bitcoin. So the quantity of Bitcoin is always going to follow the curve that I showed you earlier, regardless of how many people are using it. And instead, the difficulty of mining it is what's going to adjust. And so if the difficulty to mine it adjusts, then instead of the increased monetary demand leading to more supply of Bitcoin being introduced onto the market, what ends up happening is the increase in demand for Bitcoin ends up making mining Bitcoin more difficult, which means you need more processing power to mine Bitcoin, which effectively makes the network more secure because it has more processing power. And so this is really the cycle that you can see in terms of how Bitcoin operates. If demand for Bitcoin as a store of value increases, that causes the price of Bitcoin or the value of Bitcoin to rise. That in turn makes mining Bitcoin more profitable. So more people start directing more money and resources towards mining Bitcoin. But this does not lead to more Bitcoin being produced. Instead, it leads to the network becoming more secure. Because as we said, with the difficulty adjustment, the quantity of Bitcoin stays fixed, but the difficulty of mining new Bitcoin is increased. And so the network becomes harder and harder to attack. And then as a result, that makes it even more secure, which will likely increase the demand for store of value for Bitcoin as a store of value. And this is my explanation for why Bitcoin has, in the last 10 years, increased by about 700 million percent in value. You know, because every time somebody new wants to buy Bitcoin, there's no possibility for them to create extra Bitcoin. The only way for them to get Bitcoin is to raise the price at which they bid for it, which raises the price, which in turn makes the network more secure. And this is truly astonishing if you think about it. You know, it's this little computer program, which is intangible and it can't be touched, has in 10 years, less than 10 years, has gone from basically a value of zero to now a value exceeding $100 billion of the value of all the tokens. And every day we have billions of dollars being traded. And the network is still pretty secure because of this. So the value rises and the network continues to become more and more secure. So how secure is Bitcoin? Because of this difficulty adjustment process, the processing power behind Bitcoin, which can secure about 500,000 transactions or so, only 500,000 transactions per day, the processing power for it is 55 exahashes, which is a lot. How much? It's about 7 trillion times the size of your laptop. 7 trillion laptops, effectively. It's like 7 million of the world's top supercomputer. This is the amount of processing power taking that is going into the Bitcoin network every day. You can do 500,000 transactions on a single computer, on your own laptop. You can do many more than 500,000 transactions a day. But your own laptop can be easily attacked, it can be compromised, and it relies on your security. Bitcoin's security relies on nobody. Bitcoin's security relies on no single party, and there's no single point of failure that you can attack with it. And that's why this much processing power goes into it. So the result of this is that Bitcoin has no single point of failure. There's no single piece of critical hardware or infrastructure anywhere in the world that is necessary for Bitcoin to function. There's no building that you can destroy and then destroy Bitcoin. There's no single individual or organization that is necessary for Bitcoin to function. Any person is dispensable for Bitcoin. Effectively, Bitcoin can't really be stopped because it's just a protocol that is always open to anyone, anywhere in the world, who wants to use it. If you want to use this form of money, all you need to do is download the program on your computer, read the code, understand how it functions, and then you're able to use it. And it's every 10 minutes, you know, all that it does, that the amount of data that it consumes back and forth is pretty little, because all it does is that every 10 minutes it sends 1 megabyte of data, and that's it. 1 megabyte of data every 10 minutes is broadcast to everybody, and that records the new transactions. So this pretty simple system of about 500,000 transactions per day, every 10 minutes we get one block of transactions with 1 megabyte of data, or a little bit more than 1 megabyte. And in 10 years of operation, we have not seen a single fraudulent transaction confirmed on the Bitcoin network, which is astonishing. You know, not once has somebody been able to hack the Bitcoin network to spend money that they don't have, or to spend the same amount of money twice, to send it to two people at the same time. It has not happened once in about 10 years, which is pretty astonishing. If you remember, in the last 10 years, there's been pretty much nobody in the world that has not been hacked. You know, whether it's governments or corporations or individuals or celebrities, everything has been hacked and compromised. If it's digital, it's been hacked. And yet Bitcoin, the network itself, has never been hacked. Of course, people who use Bitcoin can be hacked. It's possible for somebody to steal your password. But the network itself has not been hacked because of this security model that has proven extremely successful, so far at least. So what this means and why I think Bitcoin is interesting is because Bitcoin is the hardest money ever invented, the hardest money to produce, no way to increase the supply beyond the original schedule. It's available worldwide for anybody with an internet connection to access, and it's purely voluntary. It doesn't need any regulation, enforcement, or police in order for it to function. And most interesting for me, as an economist influenced by the Austrian school, is that its monetary role was chosen for it freely on the market. You know, nobody forced anybody to accept Bitcoin as money. It was chosen on the market because people want it. And this is the Austrian school's definition of sound money. Sound money is money whose acceptability and whose value emerges on the market from people transacting with one another. It isn't enforced at the point of gun or by government forcing people to accept it or to accept it at a certain price. So this is, in my opinion, why Bitcoin is interesting as an economic phenomenon. So what is it good for? What is the application of such a thing? Well, for me, the first and most interesting application, the most obvious one, is that it is useful as a store of value. It is effectively the first strictly scarce liquid asset that we have ever had in this world. I mean, you know, everything else that is liquid, everything else that can be used as a monetary asset, because it's liquid and can be used for payments and can be divided and sent around, everything else, there, its supply can be increased. You know, if we want more gold, we keep digging and we keep finding more gold. And thousands of years of people digging for gold and we still haven't run out. The deeper we dig, the more we find. The limit on how much gold or oil or copper or any economic liquid asset or natural resource, the limit on how much of it exists is not the limit of how much of it exists on Earth, because the Earth is far bigger than our ability to mine it all. It's the limit is just how much time we dedicate to it. So we can always make more gold, it's just that the cost of it keeps rising. But with Bitcoin, it's different because the limit is strict. It's 21 million and that's it. It's strictly scarce. And so if you think about it, you know, one of my favorite economists, his name is Julian Simon, and I quote him in the book. He used to say, he wrote a very important and influential book that is called The Ultimate Resource. And he says, the only truly ultimate resource that exists in the world is human time. Because with human time, we can make more of anything. There's no scarcity of copper, oil, zinc, whatever it is. If we want more of it, we just need to dedicate more time for it, and we'll make more. And in the 70s, Julian Simon was always arguing with the environmentalists who, if you may remember, those of you who are around in the 70s, we were going to run out of nickel, we were going to run out of oil, we were going to run out of water, we were going to run out of everything. And yet here we are 40 years later and we have more of everything, not less. So why do we have more of it? Because we dedicate more time to it, and the more human beings we have, the more time we have, the more we can make more, the more we can make of all of these things. But Bitcoin and human time are the only two things that are scarce. And so, you know, the ultimate resource is human time, but Julian Simon, unfortunately, is not with us anymore to see that finally we have something that is as scarce as human time. And so for me, if you understand money as a store of value, you know, you use money to store the value that you produce with your time. And since your time on this earth is limited, you know, you would like to be able to store it in something that is also limited, because if the thing in which you store your money is easy to inflate, if the supply of it can be increased easily, then it is possible for people to effectively steal the value of your time by making more of it, the money that you're making, you know? So if you put your value into, say, Venezuelan bolivars today, because the government can print more and more of it, it is able to rob your value from it. So Bitcoin is effectively the strictest, scarcest asset that we've ever invented, and therefore, for me, it would be arguably useful as a store of value, at least in the very long run, and possibly our most advanced technology for transferring value across time, because it's not possible to inflate it or increase its supply. In other words, beyond that, if we use that as a store of value, in my opinion, when something becomes used as a store of value and people want to hold it, then, and not just my opinion, it's also the opinion of many economists like Stanley Jevons, the fact that you hold it means that then people will want to accept it as payment. And so after it emerges as a store of value, it is going to become a medium of exchange that people will accept for payment. And effectively, this means that it's going to start gaining more and more of a monetary role. So what we have with Bitcoin, because this monetary asset comes with a built-in payment network or a built-in settlement network, if you want, effectively what we end up with is a global payment network that has its own currency and that is able to transfer money across the world. And it is, in fact, the first truly functioning alternative to central banking that we have. So if you want to transfer money today from Spain to China, your only option up until the year 2008, your only option was to go through your local central bank, which goes through effectively pretty much wherever you are in the world, you go through the US central bank, which controls all the world's payments network and supervises them. You had no alternative if you wanted to send money across the world except to do that. But with Bitcoin today, we have an actual functioning alternative. You can send money to China with Bitcoin without having to go through your central bank. I think this is, you know, after about 100 years of central banking monopoly, this is the first example of a truly viable alternative to central banks. And it's one that is much harder for governments to shut down. And we'll see why maybe a little bit later. So what we're seeing now is that as the Bitcoin network is growing, it's beginning to look more like the gold standard, and that's from that comes the title of my book. You know, the way that gold became the only currency of the world at the end of the 19th century, it was not that every single payment was made with physical gold. People didn't walk around carrying big jugs of coins with them and using them to pay for everything. The way that the Bitcoin standard worked was that the gold was stored in banks and people used financial instruments or pieces of paper that were backed by that gold. And so for every 100 or 1,000 transactions with a piece of paper or with a letter of credit or with a bill of exchange backed by the gold, for every 1,000 movements of gold, of instruments backed by gold, you would get one movement of the physical gold itself moving from one location to the other. Effectively, when banks wanted to settle with one another, that's when the physical gold would be moving. And Bitcoin is becoming like that. The limitation on Bitcoin's scaling, people thought, well, Bitcoin can only do 500,000 transactions a day or 1 million or 2 million. That's not just not enough for the whole world, that's not enough for a small town, you know? Half of Madrid would not find the Bitcoin network payments enough. But of course, but my point of my book is that Bitcoin's payments can't be understood as consumer payments. They can't be understood as, and they're not very useful if you want to go buy with the Bitcoin network itself, with transactions on the Bitcoin network. But Bitcoin transactions can best be understood as the settlement transactions between banks. And so what we're seeing now, and this is already emerging, that the majority of Bitcoin transactions do not happen on the Bitcoin blockchain. They're not registered on Bitcoin, just like the majority of gold transactions did not involve the physical movement of gold. The physical movement of gold happens for settlement, and the physical movement of Bitcoin, if you want, or the on-chain movements of Bitcoin are happening for settlement of many, many transactions that take place off-chain. And so, you know, we might increase on-chain transactions marginally, but off-chain transactions can increase exponentially. And so, therefore, there's no limit on the scaling of Bitcoin if you think about it from that regard. So, if this is true, if we are developing an alternative to central banking, we've had a century and a bit of central banking now, and what would it mean for the world? Let's think about it. This is the interesting reason that I wrote the book, is what it would mean for the world if we were to move to a world with a currency that is hard and that is outside of the control of governments. For me, the most interesting aspect of it relates to time preference, and it's a topic that I was always very fascinated with before I got into Bitcoin, and as I got into Bitcoin, it was always something that that I kept thinking about. Specifically, the way that I think of it is this. If money is easy, if the value of your money is expected to collapse over time, if you think that, you know, the 100 euros that you have today, in 1 year they're going to be worth, let's say, 5% less, you are far more likely to spend that money today than if you would expect that 100 euros will be worth 5% more next year, right? If you expect it to go up, you're more likely to hold on to it. If you expect it to go down, you're more likely to spend it. So easy money, effectively, encourages people to spend more. Hard money encourages people to save and spend less. Of course, another way of understanding this mechanism is through interest rates. Easy money, increase in the supply of money, causes interest rates to drop artificially low, which gives people an incentive to consume more and gives them less of an incentive to save. So if you think about it that way, you know, low time preference, the ability of human beings to lower our time preference is what drives us towards saving, is what drives us towards beginning to think of the future, is what drives us towards capital accumulation. Capital accumulation, once we develop the ability to accumulate capital, it increases our productivity. You know, when we moved from catching fish with our hands to catching fish with a fishing rod to then using big boats for catching fish, all that is happening as we increase the capital stock is that our productivity goes up. You know, the fisherman who tries to catch fish with their hands is able to catch 5 fish per day. The one who uses a big giant boat with modern electronic equipment is able to catch 10,000 fish per day. So the productivity continues to go up, which means better material living standards. This is why economist Hans Hermann Hoppe, also from the Austrian school, calls low time preference, says that low time preference is what initiates the process of civilization. It's what brings about the process of accumulating capital and building modern society that continues to improve material standards for people. So many people wonder then, well, you know, if we have hard money, and this is one of the most common objections to Bitcoin, which is that if money is going to appreciate in value, nobody will spend anything. And if people stop spending, then the economy crashes. And then if the economy crashes, you know, children die. And so if you like Bitcoin, clearly you want children to die, as most Keynesian economists would accuse us Bitcoiners. However, you know, on closer scrutiny, we find that that's not exactly accurate. And for illustrating that, I always like to point out this example. This is a 10 megabyte hard disk, which in 1980 you could have gotten for $3,495. Now, how much can you buy a 10 megabyte drive today? Well, you can't find one today, but you know, if you wanted to buy 10 megabytes, they probably cost less than 1 cent, or maybe 10 cents or something like that. That's roughly the price of 10 megabytes. So why would anybody in 1980 buy a hard drive like this when they could just wait 38 years and buy it for 10 cents, right? And in fact, you know, why do you buy your iPhone today for 700 euros or whatever when you can just wait 10 years and then you'll pick it up at the, you know, from the junk store for 5 euros or something like that? Why do you buy it for 700 today? Well, the answer is that time preference is always positive. In other words, people always prefer present consumption over future consumption because ultimately, because our time on this earth is limited. We are going to die one day, and you don't know if you're going to die before you get the hard drive, and so you would rather get it now. You know, you think about also the people that bought this hard drive in 1980. Were they better off for buying it, or should they have waited and for the price to drop? Well, buying it in 1980 allows you to, you know, it could be that Steve Jobs bought this exact hard drive in 1980. And it helped him build the company that he built, and it helped him become productive. So does the fact that the price of things will drop stop you from consuming completely? Of course not. Will the if I told you that the price of food next year is going to be cheaper than today, will you spend the whole year hungry waiting for the price of the food to drop? Obviously not. You need to eat today. So Keynesians are correct in identifying the mechanism of the hard money reducing consumption. They're incorrect in assuming that this is going to eliminate consumption. It won't eliminate consumption because people need to eat and survive. What it's going to do is that it's going to reduce people's frivolous consumption. It's going to reduce the people's consumption of things that they don't need. If you look around the world around you today, you know, you notice people are buying a lot of stuff that they don't need all the time. You notice people buying a lot of plastic crap that they don't need and that keeps accumulating in garbage dumps all the time. And it's because, ultimately, because easy money encourages people to spend more and more. It encourages people to think about the present because money is like a hot potato. If you keep it in your pocket, it loses its value. So if you save it, you earn low interest on it. If you borrow, you can borrow at low interest. So consumerism can only really be understood as a product of easy money. And it's something that I think Bitcoin is likely to fix. And we can also see this if we look at saving rates across the Western world since 1970, which is when the final link between the dollar or between currencies and gold was removed. As you can see, savings rates have basically been dropping all the time. And the only exception to this has been Switzerland, which was the last country to abandon the gold standard in the West, and it stayed on gold for a much longer time, and as a result, it has a little bit of a higher savings rate. If you look at the savings rates in the 19th century, they were generally much higher in these Western economies, and that's how these Western economies became more developed. But even beyond just simply saving and consuming, time preference is not just an economic factor. It's once our material needs are met as humans, we can focus on other things beyond our just survival. And I think in my book, my favorite chapter of the book, the one that really motivated me to write the book, was chapter 5, And it talks about the implications of time preference to society at large in terms of people, technology, morality, culture, art, music. I think all of these things reflect people's time preference. And, you know, I don't have time to go over it in depth, but I do have, they say a picture is more powerful than 1,000 words. So two pictures, that's 2,000 words for you right there. This here is the Sistine Chapel in Italy. And this here, anybody know what this is? Who drew this? Yep, a guy called Rothko. So 400 years ago, when people spoke about art, you know, this was Michelangelo hanging from a ceiling of the Sistine Chapel for 4 years, trying to draw this. And then he wrote a poem, which I quote in my article, talking about how much this destroyed his health, all the problems it gave him, how exhausting it was, how much work and time went into producing this. And, you know, this is the reason it survives today. Compared to the kind of things that we call art today, which effectively take 15 minutes to build and 7 minutes to develop the skill set needed for it. There isn't a 15-year-old in the world who couldn't produce this after 20 minutes of giving them just a little bit of colors. And you know, I'm sure there are some modern art fans here who might get upset. Sure, there's no disputing in taste. There's no argument about taste. However, there is argument about time. This thing takes far more time to produce and skill than that. And I think it's no coincidence that we live in a time in which most of our art is very simple, very fast, easy to produce. And it's not just the art, you see this in everything. And I think it's impossible to understand these things outside of the context of time preference. And this is what excites me about Bitcoin personally, because I think it can, once people, and if you talk to Bitcoiners, many of them report this, once they start being able to save money in Bitcoin and watch it appreciate, their entire perspective on spending and on consuming changes, and their perspective changes from day-to-day decision making, surviving day-to-day, which is what almost everybody thinks of these days, to trying to develop more of a long-term orientation about decision making. And I think this is also reflected in terms of technology. If you look at and I talk in depth about different qualitative and quantitative measures of innovation. Arguably, I would say the end of the 19th century was the most innovative period of human history. All of the things that we think of as 20th century inventions were really invented pre-1914 under the gold standard. And I think it's no coincidence that it came under hard money. You know, the airplane, hot and cold running water, electricity, internal combustion engine, the reason that we have a modern world, the reason we're not all dying from diseases and our lives continue to improve is because of these technologies that were developed then. In the 20th century, we improved on these technologies, we made them cheaper, they spread all over the world, but the true innovation of these things, almost all of them, all of the most important ones came in the 19th century under the gold standard. And I think this is why, in my opinion, time preference is really the fundamental causal force in building civilizations. And rising time preference, or people who start thinking more and more about the present, is how people start reducing their capital stock, how this capital stock is reduced over time, and society becomes essentially reverses the process of civilization, which some would argue is what we're going through right now. Secondly, I think the second implication of having that kind of monetary system, if Bitcoin continues to grow, and of course everything I'm saying here, is not a prediction. It is more rather an extrapolation of what would happen if Bitcoin continued to function. And I make no guarantees for anybody that Bitcoin is going to continue to function or succeed. And this is not an invitation for anybody to invest in Bitcoin. I don't care if you buy Bitcoin, you probably shouldn't. If you want to, you should probably read about it and be careful about how you use it and learn about it. The real investment is in learning how to use it before you put any money into it. But I think if it continues to grow, if more and more people continue to hold it and the value continues to rise, the ability that more and more of the population in the world will be using a monetary standard that can't be created by governments, whose supply can't be increased by government, that effectively means that government is going to have less and less ability to finance itself through inflation. Even beyond that, we know that today most capital is becoming informational. There was a time in which capital was industrial and it was physical and it was easy for governments to capture it. But capital now is becoming informational. People who are highly productive, usually they are not highly productive because they hold machines, they are highly productive because they have great ideas and training in their mind that allows them to be highly productive. So as capital becomes informational, and as money, which is Bitcoin, becomes also information and very hard to track down and impossible to confiscate, well, not impossible, but harder to confiscate, it becomes far easier to move that stuff around, and it becomes far harder for governments to capture it. When capital was factories, government had to send a bunch of people with a gun and to put it to the head of the guy who runs the factory, and if you don't hand them over your money, you know, they can shoot you and the factory will continue to operate. But if your capital is information, if your capital is training, and they shoot you, the capital is gone. So it's much harder to confiscate that. And so that means that government's territorial monopoly is going to count for less and less, and that governments will have to effectively compete for productive people rather than try and extort them. And so that the places that are the most hospitable to productivity are likely to become more and more productive over time. So you would expect that you would see less and less role for the nanny state, for the managerial state, and more of a return to the model of classical liberal limited government that we saw in the 19th century. Or even beyond that, you know, government based essentially on consent, or government as just, you know, effectively not government anymore. Once it's just purely based on the consensual dealings between others, you know, I like to call it the Swissification of the world. You know, Switzerland, you know, if you... Anybody here knows who is the president of Switzerland? Never did I do this and get in the question, an answer to this. Nobody knows the president of Switzerland. Not even the Swiss people know the president of Switzerland. Why? Because he doesn't do anything. It doesn't matter. You could put a monkey as the president of Switzerland and the country will continue to operate. He just needs to cut a few ribbons every now and then and stand up and take a nice photo and that's it. But everybody knows the president of Venezuela. Everybody knows the president of North Korea. Why? Because he matters a lot to everybody living in Venezuela and North Korea. I don't think it's a coincidence that most people would rather live in Switzerland than in North Korea, because in Switzerland, regardless of who the president is, your economic reality, your life is governed by you to a much larger extent than the government. And, you know, I think this idea, I think, it's likely to spread if we, you know, the reason Switzerland is like that is because Switzerland was on hard money for a very long time. Most countries were like that in the 19th century on hard money. Most European countries were like that in the 19th century on hard money, and they changed as the government had the printing press and was able to finance itself with inflating the money supply. So I would expect that you would have less and less role for government, and then you would get a reemergence of the role for family, for local community, as a replacement for government, or to be as a return for them, and to take away the role of government as their replacement, which is what government has done over the last 100 years. Finally, the exciting thing for an economist from the Austrian school about Bitcoin is that this is hard money that can't really be manipulated. And this is a huge deal, because from the Austrian economics perspective, and we could get into this in more detail in the discussion, but I won't bore you with it right now because I can go on for hours and hours about this. You know, from the Austrian business cycle, what the Austrian business cycle says is that the only reason you can get recessions and financial crises and inflation is because of central planning of the money supply, or because of the central planning of the capital markets. In other words, when governments reduce the interest rate artificially in order to allow people to invest more because, you know, they want to raise GDP and raise productivity, they obviously can't create more resources for society. All that they can do is they give people the illusion that they have more resources. People start investing and spending more than they think that they can, more than they actually have. But we haven't increased the size of actual productive resources. All that we've done is we've misallocated it. We've made people make incorrect decisions about how to allocate their capital. And the result of that is always that this misallocation is later exposed and businesses collapse. And this is, you know, the business cycle that you see in the housing bubbles, that you see in the dot-com bubble, the stock market bubble. And effectively, from the Austrian perspective, all of these bubbles are just the inevitable consequence of easy money, inevitable consequence of governments trying to manipulate the money supply. In other words, you know, if you look at, say, Poland in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, they always had problems and shortages of oranges and bananas and apples and all these agricultural goods, because all of the market for those things were centrally planned and controlled by governments. And yet, after, here we are, you know, after communism has collapsed in these countries, now you go to Poland and they never have a shortage of oranges or apples, you know. It's not the geography, obviously. It's because today, you know, even in the middle of winter, you can still buy mangoes in Poland. But in the 1960s, you could never buy even mangoes, or most crops could never be existing. Why? Because of the manipulation of the price. Essentially, the central planning of the price will always cause misallocations in the economy and will cause shortages or surpluses. And the same applies for capital markets. The interest rate is just the price of capital. And so manipulating the interest rate is manipulating the price of capital, and that will cause problems in the capital market. And so effectively, all of these problems, if you ask me, are the result of easy money. And Bitcoin, or hard money in general, is the solution to these problems. So another, my favorite example as always, is Switzerland. This is Switzerland on your on the gold standard. This is the unemployment rate. It was practically zero. And the inflation rate was also very, very low at that time. Contrary to Keynesian theory, which says that there's a negative relationship between inflation and unemployment, that if you have high inflation, you can't have high unemployment. Well, they had low inflation and low unemployment. This is how it was in Switzerland up until the 1970s. And then once they stopped being on the gold standard, now, like everybody else, they're getting all these recessions and all this permanent class of unemployed people that is just an inevitable outcome of the fact that the capital markets are always in distorted, and capital and labor is always being misallocated because of the manipulation of the price mechanism. So in my opinion, you know, these things could end on a hard money standard. And if Bitcoin is that, it might really be an enormously beneficial innovation for humanity if it can put an end to government manipulation of capital markets. Beyond that, simply getting rid of the idea of global exchange rates and global foreign exchange, I think perhaps, you know, one of the worst things that has happened in the 20th century is the uninvention of a uniform global monetary standard. And that is the gold standard. The gold standard in the 19th century was the pinnacle of human achievement in terms of economic systems. You know, you could be sitting in Madrid, building something with ingredients from all over the world, and you buy them from everywhere in the world, and you calculate the price of everything in gold, and then you sell it all over the world to people all over the world who pay you in gold. So you're able to calculate all of the prices of all of your inputs and all of your outputs and all of your sales in gold all over the world. And that was the economy that gave us this enormously innovative world. That was the economy of global peace. There's a reason that period from 1870 to 1910 was called, in French they call it La Belle Époque, in America they call it the Gilded Age, in Britain it's the Victorian era, that it was the peak of the Victorian era. There was little war going on all over the world. There was peace, mostly. People were trading all over the world on one monetary standard. It was a stable monetary standard that was used all across the world because of its stability, it allowed for a lot of cooperation between everybody everywhere. And the notion that we uninvented that and replaced it with national currencies, regional currencies, is effectively like going back to barter. I mean, it's almost as counterproductive as uninventing languages. And, you know, let's uninvent Spanish and give every family its own language, and then they have a dictionary between them and the other family, and then every time you want to talk to somebody, you need to convert from your language to theirs. The benefit of having one monetary standard is enormous. And the result of it, you know, today is that the foreign exchange market is about 25 times the size of global GDP, because every time you want to buy something from somebody who lives across a border that has a different currency, you know, not only do you have to calculate it in their currency, but also the value of the currency, yours and theirs, is always fluctuating. So because of this, you know, businesses go out of business, not because they make wrong decisions, but because the foreign exchange rates that they use for the supplies that they get or for the markets that they sell to have fluctuated. So something like Brexit could put a Spanish company out of business, even though the Spanish company was very profitable. But because their competitors are British and now the British pound has collapsed, their competitors have a massive advantage, the Spanish company goes out of business. It's absolutely insane that we have all of this. And more companies are dedicating more and more of their resources just to try and get over this system of international barter, you know, trying to figure out how do we play the foreign exchange market in a way that stops us from going bankrupt if something happens in Britain, or if the euro goes down, or if the Swiss franc goes up. And it's absolutely insane that we have to think about that. It's insane that a car company needs to have a foreign exchange department, you know? And this did not exist 100 years ago or 120 years ago. And I think getting rid of this would be an absolutely wonderful boon for humanity, among all of the other things that I mentioned in terms of Bitcoin. In other words, you know, and of course, you know, the political aspect of it, of the fact that today, if we have government money, that means one government has to issue one money that is global, that is acceptable across countries, and that government then develops what is called the exorbitant privilege, which is the ability to print money and finance their operations just by passing on the inflation of the currency to the rest of the world. And that's effectively what drives the current world economy around the U.S., and so now U.S. fiscal and monetary policy is all over the world. It's, you know, it's already absurd enough that the price of capital is determined by a central planning bureau of six or seven PhDs in economics in the U.S. It's absurd for the U.S., but it's even more absurd to think that the entire planet has to follow that, because U.S. monetary policy is global monetary policy. You don't get to vote for Americans, but you still get to import their monetary policy. And I think this is really the promise of what Bitcoin could do. This is why I think Bitcoin is really exciting and really interesting. And, you know, it's basically a politically neutral, censorship-free settlement system which separates politicians' morality from people. It's a free market in money, savings, capital, and investments. And if you've seen how much free markets can transform societies, you know, just look at the example of Eastern European countries. I think the possibilities from a free market in money, savings, capital, and investment is an absolutely amazing one, and one that is well worth anticipating and looking forward to. Thank you very much. This is my website and my email, and this is the cover of the book. Thank you very much for coming and for attending this.